Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
1 week from today, jury selection begins in the trial of reputed Boston mobster James Whitey Bulger. He was captured 2 years ago, and since then we've heard a lot about his 16 years on the run and about the crimes, including the murders he allegedly committed. We've heard less about how James Bulger of South Boston became the ruthless and feared Whitey Bulger. Now Dick Lair and Gerald O'Neill, former Boston Globe journalists, do that in their new book, Whitey: The Life of America's Most Notorious Mob Boss. Dick Lair joined us recently to talk about what he called the making of a monster, beginning with Bulger's relationship with his father, James Bulger Sr.
They didn't get along very well. Whitey complained and reported when he was arrested to probation officials that his father beat him. Later in life, when his father died, we interviewed people. He said he's better off dead. I mean, there was that lifelong tension, even animosity. Mm-hmm. And another notable fact, I think, in the context of the 1940s, again, when Whitey's his formative years as a teenager, what jumped out to us in kind of a new way in stark relief is that their father was a very old man, relatively speaking. He was in his late 50s, early 60s, when Whitey's 11, 12 years old. These were the war years. These were when every able-bodied man would assert his manhood and go off to fight and represent the country and whatnot. Their father was sidelined by both age and disability.
I see.
I think that has an impact on Whitey Bulger.
And so without this sort of family mooring, I guess, Whitey really grows up in the streets of South Boston, which you refer to as his training ground and a sort of an apprenticeship for his criminal career. I wonder if you can paint the picture for us. What were the streets of Southie like in the 1940s?
Sure. And what we're talking about is they didn't move into the Old Harbor Housing Project until 1938 when it opened. Whitey was born in 1929. The family moved around Dorchester, Charlestown. They were kicking around. They hadn't found the mooring, the anchor in South Boston for which they are in many ways famous for, and most people assume that they were of and born and of South Boston. So when they moved into the Old Harbor Housing Project, you know, Whitey was 9 or 10, and he was used to his freedom and used to being out and about, whereas younger Bill, by 5 years, was still close to home. The mother was very much in charge. He could be steered into St. Monica's Church, and he could be steered into organized activities of like that. But Whitey was already off and running and onto the streets of South Boston, which back in the late 30s and 1940s was divided up by street gangs, jumping on the backs of trucks to steal stuff, shoplifting along the markets along Broadway.
You write that Whitey had a history of getting away with things, which begins at a young age. He somehow avoids being sent to the disciplinary Lyman School for Boys, right?
Yes, yep.
Which was like a juvenile jail. He was charged with attempted rape, and he gets off by paying a fine.
Paying a fine, yeah. He always found a way, in 9 or 10 instances, to elude any real consequence. So in the system or at home, this starts feeding his narcissism, his psychopathy, that is, everyone, I think, agrees is part of Whitey Bulger's makeup at this point. Fast forward to the FBI years, and in his legal argument today, I'm immune from prosecution.
Entitlement.
Entitlement. Yeah. I always have. And you find seeds of this at age 12, 13, and 14 on the streets of South Boston when he does these assaults, thefts. He turns a sentence to Lyman around so he goes home instead of to the juvenile prison.
That's fascinating. Let me ask you about his character and personality. You know, we know, I mean, he's described as a ruthless murderer, very, very tough. But he was also attractive, charismatic, a hugely forceful presence and personality, right?
In my mind, they can go hand in hand.
Sure.
He is a psychopath, and that's someone who is full of themselves, knows the difference between right and wrong, but just doesn't care. As part of that narcissism, that's where we see the Whitey who is known and all the different stories about how he could be very friendly and charismatic and helpful to those around him. Well, I would argue that this is Whitey's narcissism. It's not genuine. It's to serve him. It's to have that immediate circle around him have good thoughts about him. So he, in a sense, neutralizes them.
Well, let's talk about his early life in crime. He's robbing banks. He gets ratted out by some of his accomplices, and he's sent to prison for 120-year sentence. And you and Gerald O'Neill write extensively about his time in Alcatraz. What happens there, and how does that continue to shape him?
Interestingly, it was at the Rock where I think we saw evidence of a whole bunch of things. First of all, the access to political power that Whitey benefited from. And by that, I mean his brother emerging as his advocate in chief, tapping into one of the most powerful politicians in America, John McCormick.
This is the former U.S. House Speaker.
Absolutely. Right. What inmate anywhere, anytime, wouldn't want to have the House Speaker of the United States?
This is extraordinary. Right. Now explain what someone like, I mean, Bill Bulger we've heard about, but House Speaker John McCormick, how is he helping Whitey Bulger in Alcatraz?
Okay. The connection is because McCormick is from South Boston.
Right.
He's their congressman, and the family, through Bill Bulger, reaches out to him. The results are you have House Speaker McCormick regularly contacting prison officials, whether it's the superintendent at a particular prison or the director of the entire federal prison system, the Bureau of Prisons, also the heads of the Parole Commission. These people are taking notice, and whether it was Whitey's prison file or in the McCormick papers, which are here at Boston University, we found evidence and records of communications down to the minute, updating on Whitey's status in prison, his efforts to get transferred out of the Rock, his efforts to get paroled. McCormick's fingerprints are all over the file. All the officials involved were very aware of McCormick's interests and often responded right away to the McCormick office whenever he made a query. It's remarkable.
And I'm interested to hear about this FBI thing because, of course, the FBI comes to Whitey to recruit him as an informant, but he's able to manipulate the agency so effectively to serve his own criminal ends, his own criminal enterprise.
I think what you're hitting on, Anthony, is what makes Whitey Bulger, I think, the significant crime figure now in the last century. Is not necessarily the murders that he's been linked to or the fortunes he amassed in his underworld reign of terror, not his longevity because he has survived for so long and was at the top for so long. It's that when you say Whitey Bulger in the same breath, you have to say the FBI.
Yeah.
And what he's done, what no other crime boss, I think, has ever done, is to turn this Boston office into his palace guard. He was a genius at that. It was supposed to be all one way, in a sense, the FBI recruiting underworld figures, getting intelligence against the mafia. Well, very quickly, Whitey realized that through Conley, he had someone he could control, the agent handler. He had Conley working for him. He had Conley giving him stuff, leaking to him things he needed to know to not only solidify his place in the underworld, but to rise to the top.
Mm-hmm. Has this Boston FBI office fully recovered from this big black mark on its history because of these Whitey Bulger years, in your view?
I'm not sure they've moved out completely. And I think a big indication of that was following Whitey's arrest in June of 2011. I think the FBI had this sense that finally the skies are going to open. Instead, the FBI was hit with tons of questions about their explanation and their description of the arrest. No one believed it. It came down the way it happened, which was a tip from a woman from Iceland, all that story.
Yeah,
I think that was a huge reflection that when it comes to Whitey Bulger, the FBI's credibility is shot.
Speaking of the arrest, I want to ask you about his time in California on the run, because you take a really close look of these years before his capture. When he takes on the name Charlie Gasco in Santa Monica with his girlfriend, Catherine Gregg, who goes by the name Carol Gasco, and you actually work with a forensic psychologist on this part of the story and explore the question of how Whitey was able to essentially flip the switch from ruthless murderer to reserved retiree. What did you find?
What drives him is more about power and control. He could put on the mask of Charlie Gasco because that kept him free. Catch me if you can, and you can't. That's the game. Things like murder and being, you know, all the money and stuff like that, those are trappings of his sort of brain power and tick. But it was about survival and control.
And, of course, the racketeering and murder trial of Whitey Bulger is coming up in June. What do you think he's hoping to get out of this trial? How do you think he's processing it? Based on what you've learned about his psychology and the making of who he is, how do you think he's processing this?
Well, you know, he's insisting he's going to testify through his attorney. I sure hope he does. Mm-hmm. As far as processing it, it's filtered through this sense of control. He doesn't like people thinking the worst of him. And so he'll spin it in a way that makes him more palatable in mm-hmm. the scheme of things. And it fits this lifelong theme that you trace back to early Whitey Bulger. I'm a bad guy, but I'm not such a bad guy.
Yeah.
I'm a good bad guy. That is, you know, that could be the title of his autobiography.
The good bad guy.
I'm a good bad guy.
Wow.
And that underlies these claims. I'm not an informant. I don't kill women. You know, it all ties up around that kind of core theme of his.
Well, more to come. The book is Whitey, The Life of America's Most Notorious Mob Boss. Dick Lehr is a former reporter of the Boston Globe and the co-author, along with Gerald O'Neill. Dick Lehr, thank you so much.
Thanks, Anthony.
And stay with us. Still to come on the program, in the season of commencement addresses, we revisit a great one from 50 years ago when President John F. Kennedy offered his strategy for peace. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.